You're listening to a University of Minnesota Bookstore author event podcast, recorded live from our location in Kauffman Memorial Union on the U of M's Twin Cities campus. For more information on upcoming author events, please visit our website at bookstore.umn.edu.
Our special guest today is James Levine. He's a professor of medicine at the Mayo Clinic, a world-renowned scientist, doctor, and researcher. He lives in Orinoco, Minnesota, just outside of Rochester. Just a note, all of the author's proceeds from the sale of this novel is donated to the International Center for Missing and Exploited Children and the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children. We're very pleased to have him with us today to talk about his new book, and then he will take your questions afterwards. So please join me in welcoming James Levine.
Well, thank you. This is it's a real pleasure to be here. Of course, for us at Mayo, you know, the University of Minnesota is a collaborator, whereas I think a decade ago that didn't seem to be the case to me. This has been an extraordinary road trip, in every sense of the word, and I was just asked today to perhaps go through that road trip, if I might. But I think for me also, quite interestingly, if I may, I'd like to mention some of the consequences of this novel. It's a piece of fiction, let alone the fact that the book has been published in 36 countries around the world, and the influence and the programs, should I say, that have been associated or linked to it. I will tell you that this has been an entirely humbling experience that I would recommend to anybody. And of course, it all started in a very, very strange way. I've never written fiction before. Some of my colleagues would claim I don't write science either. But I came off the back of a trip to Africa, where we were working in the Ivory Coast, trying to work out the interplay between women's labor, how women work in agricultural regions, and how society and culture influence the work burden of women. And we did this work very laboriously, and it was very, very interesting. And we took the same paradigms, the same ways of measuring things to children, and evaluated child labor in agricultural regions, how children are used to support agricultural communities. And it's not entirely exploitation, there's a necessity. Part of the work we did identified that unless children do work in agriculture in these particular regions, the economies would go bust and everyone would starve. So it's nothing's black and white in the world, except what I'm about to tell you. So from there, I flew back, and I was due to go to India to do very similar work, looking at underserved regions. We have underserved programs not only in the Ivory Coast, but also in Kenya. I do some work in the Congo, and also we work in China and Jamaica and so on. And so we're going to do similar work in the slums in Mumbai. And so flying from Africa, I flew through Amsterdam to Delhi, where we're supposed to meet these various government officials. My plane got diverted in the fog to Mumbai, then got flown back to Delhi. It was just after 3 a.m, I come running out of and as I tell this again, I have to relive this, which is sort of incredibly embarrassing. I come out of those sort of these swing doors in Delhi Airport, and somebody's supposed to meet me and so on. And I come running out with my trolley and my bags, and you know, just I think this is purely sleep deprivation rather than gross stupidity. I'm running out with my passport in this hand, with rupees I've just changed in the exchange sticking out of my passport, like pushing my trolley through and somewhat exhausted. And as I'm doing so, a little boy comes up underneath me and says, "Taxi, sir, taxi, sir." And I say, "Oh, yeah, taxi, taxi." And the boy like smiles and like pushes my trolley, and I was sort of like fleeing behind my trolley of bags. And as we're sort of pushing along, I'm looking at the left, and all these trolleys and all these taxis are sort of disappearing down there as this boy is flying forwards with my bags. And after about less than a quarter of a mile, we enter a warehouse. And as soon as we enter a warehouse, it's sort of rather cinematic. The door slams shut behind us. And all of a sudden, in this sort of empty warehouse, and there's a beaten-up car that looks a bit like a VW, just to give a Beetle, just to give you a sense of the size. But it's not a VW; it's sort of beaten up and tan-coloured. And there are these four young gentlemen who very encouragingly pushed me into the car and sat on either side of me and at the front and in the obviously the driver. Now, I really am one of these people who believe the world, the cup is always three quarters full. And so I was absolutely convinced that this was just another taxi service. And I was just about to get ripped off, like I've been ripped off in almost every country I've visited by some taxi driver. I just view that as part of the pace of the world. And if anyone here is a taxi driver, I mean, obviously no disrespect. I mean, there are lots of good taxi drivers. And off we go. And I realise something is not quite right when we're driving into Delhi through the commercial, on the commercial road. So we're in this tiny little car and there are all these painted trucks on either side of us and you feel like really, really small. And we then pull into a deserted gas station and sort of bad went to worse because there was waiting a larger car, in fairness, a black car. And I was taken out of that car and put into the next car. And in the next car, there were four other chaps waiting, although all of them were standing outside with blankets wrapped around their faces. And still there was a sort of an inkling of hope that this was sort of an advanced limo service with an airport to car park shuttle and then, you know, shuttle to luxury hotel delivery. And there was still that glimmer of hope until about 45 minutes later when I said, you know, Hotel Intercontinental, I'm sorry, sir, the driver said, I'm afraid the hotel is closed. And I said, no, it's not closed. And I said, I'll give you a fantastic tip, but we need to go there right now. He says, sorry, sir, it's closed. And then my heart started sinking. And I actually put my passport down my trousers. And at the time I had a Dell computer, as they still exist, right? And I took the battery and slid it up my sleeve. I mean, they're terribly useful weapons for those of you who like to multitask with your computers. And actually what happened is the car, a motorcycle stopped the car I was in, and this chap on my left got out and was, you know, rolling out some money to the motorcycle driver, and obviously to me this was my chance. So I opened the door and ran out into the Delhi streets at about almost 4 in the morning. And I'll tell you, interestingly, Delhi is actually very quiet at 4 in the morning. And so I go running down the street, and then this motorcycle, you know, comes from behind me and around the front. And reassuringly, on the plastic sort of windshield, it has police across the front. And the guy says, back in the car. And of course, I'm, you know, greatly reassured by this. So I go back in the car. The car follows the police motorcycle to a travel agent. And then I'm kidnapped. And I'm put in this concrete cell box door thing. And the really funny thing, there were several funny things amidst the things that are less funny, but one of the funniest thing, and I still think about this, and you know, I'm sort of like I suppose like a lot of people, you know, we're all terribly materialistic. One day I want to go back and get this. As I walk into the room, there's this sort of very attractive vase on the left side against the left wall, and it's sort of shaped like this, and it's bronze with little jewels on it, and I actually think to myself, despite all of this, that's really, really pretty. That would like make a really nice present to bring back to the States, and it actually proves to be my toilet. Subsequently. And in fairness, I haven't seen a more attractive toilet recently than that. And so I'm put in this room and locked there, and there's a steel gate. And actually, interestingly, there's the India-Pakistan cricket game, which is a 5-day test match, going on in the room where the boys are sitting. And so I'm listening to this, and you know, there are roars. And that's how I know day and night, because obviously cricket's played during the day, or at least it was. It's now changed. But then it was so that was my... And the other way I knew day and night was because in the morning the boys would bring me chai from the street. Now, chai in the street isn't quite what you get in Starbucks because it's made, the tea is diluted with root of opium. And the reason for that is the tea is expensive, root of opium is not. And so it's a way of diluting it. But I'm telling you, you know, after a couple of days of this, it's like, you're waiting for that tea. And, you know, for about an hour or so afterwards, you're like sort of, you're very upbeat and positive. And then as soon as the tea has sort of got out your system, so to speak, I entered this sort of sense of absolute fatalism, which isn't a nice place to go in one's mind, even to relive it. It's this sense that there's nothing behind and there's nothing forwards, and for all those family, loved ones, for all that hard work, all the nonsense we live, there's nothing. I mean, there's just nothing behind, there's nothing forwards, and there's all nothingness, and it's just this room and occasional cheers through the door, and that's all there was. And it was like that for just over 3 days. And then, and I didn't do well, actually. You know, we always believe in self-fortitude, but I wouldn't claim I had much. And what I had was dissolved away pretty quickly. So, enough of that. So after about three days, just over 3 days, the door unbolts, and a squad, if you like, a team of black jackets come in. That's sort of like the SWAT team in Delhi. And they have Kevlar jackets on. And you know, I'd love to say they had guns, and it was all very exciting. And, you know, but it wasn't. And the door literally opened, and the bloke looked at me sitting on the floor next to the very attractive vase. And because you do that, because it's kind of handy. Said, you're free. To which I said, thank you. Which is obviously what one does say. And then that was it. And they assigned me a policeman, a very nice young chap, who thought I was... Then I did get to the Intercontinental, and they gave me the president's suite. I met the head of the hotel and all the staff, and nice to meet you, all that kind of thing. Had flowers. I mean, they kind of got a good deal out of me when you think about it, because they got 3 nights of accommodation for free, because I hadn't been there, right? So the upgrade to the president's suite wasn't quite as fancy-schmancy as you think, but still, it was a good deal. Free bathing robe, the whole thing. And the policeman with me thought I was going to sleep that day, but I didn't. I actually said, I'd really like to go to the Taj Mahal, because the next day I knew I was going to go back to Mumbai, where I was supposed to be. So he took me to the Taj Mahal, and because he's police, I got to be in the Taj Mahal all by myself at 7 at night. Yeah, you can imagine. It's like, it's extraordinary, because you're in this marble edifice for love. And I suppose there's lots of poetry to this in a way. And, you know, all there by oneself, and you're looking out over the river, and the light was falling. And it's just these tinkling sounds of water and absolutely nothing else. And the whole experience was extraordinary. And off I go to Mumbai, meet up with my team. My team are absolutely, this is podcast, right? Pissed off with me, annoyed with me. They really are quite irritated, because they believe that I've just taken 3 days off in Delhi to go touristing. And I've finally condescended to join them, and they've been working like really hard in these very difficult areas. And finally, I condescended to join, and I didn't sort of shatter their illusion, because I didn't particularly want to talk about anything. So off we go, and I tell you, work's great for immersing yourself in your own sort of self misery, because all of a sudden the world seems a much brighter place. So off we go, and we're talking to these extraordinary people, and this is true everywhere I go. People who have nothing, who live right on the edge of sort of survivalism, who are every day, the primary objective is get something enough to eat or whatever it may be, or save mother or whatever it is, right? And the utter joyousness and how people laugh and joke and josh each other is like something you don't see in Minneapolis for all the wonderful things we have. And so that always is totally uplifting to me, and I get quite addicted to that. It's a very, very wonderful thing. And so we're going through meeting all these people and so on. And at the very, very end of the day, the police car is at the top of the street, actually about 200 yards from a police station. This is where he's parked it. And the policeman who actually appears in the book, not in a complimentary way, I might add, he's like, going up the top of the road. He's obviously sort of quite ticked off that he's been assigned these tourists. And we're there with the United Nations, and we've got all these people, and he's responsible for everybody, and he's really quite excited to get to his car, and I suddenly see this girl, and it's in Tanner Street, and Tanner Street is where the protagonist of The Blue Notebook, Batuk, lives, and works, and she's a 14-year-old girl, and she's a young lady who's enslaved in childhood prostitution, and. To give you a sense of what this place is actually like, there are places in the way Mumbai works is there are streets with designated function for shopping. a fantastic commercial city and very, very exciting, great fun. You know, there's a street, for example, with just wedding invitations. So every shop sells wedding invitations. And it's quite amazing. I mean, you know, you think you can go to Hallmark.com and get fantastic stuff. But you should see like 5-layer handmade wedding invitations. It's incredible. And then there's a stationery. And then there's a street very near Tanner Street where people make gates, like the gating in front of our homes. But these gates with skewers and shapes are hand... this kind of thing. You know, they're made by hand. You know, no machines grinding down the steel. They're hand... it's incredible. And somebody... and you'll go up the street in the morning and somebody's starting with a thick piece. You go down at the end of the day and they've made one piece, one jot of a railing. I mean, it's extraordinary. And so there are all these streets with functions. And there is one street where the little cells are cells for young ladies, 90% ladies, 10% men dressed, young boys dressed as girls, and the girls and boys are for sale, like any other commercial entity. And the street, just like any other commercial street, is packed with taxis, and they're sort of yellow and black taxis with making a lot of noise all the time, and people bustling, you know, to and from work and whatever it may be. And you only know the sort of the clients, so to speak, because they slow down and they stop, right? Lots of people glance, I'll tell you that, but they stop and they're the clients. And the kids are really interesting. They're children, and they're unmistakably children, and they're pretty. They're obviously dressed up to attract clients. And just like you, as I was mentioning, it's what's extraordinary is there are times if you're there that the kids are laughing. They're, as I said, they're pushing each other. There's one girl I'm thinking of who would sit between two elderly women who are sort of somewhat less attractive than they might have been, and she would sit between them. That was her place, and they would be joking. They'd be chatting all day. Chatting all day, and she'd laugh, and they'd all like she obviously was quite rude to them because they'd like push her. It's hysterically funny, but then a customer would come and take her away for half an hour. And so we walked up these streets, we interviewed the people, we interviewed madams, and we went into the back streets to try and understand some of the social and structural infrastructure that supports this industry. And just at the very, very end of the street, the penultimate cell on the left, was this girl. And she was standing there in this pink sari with a rainbow trim. And you'll see the book's obviously dedicated to her. And she's standing there leaning against her gate, her concertina gate, writing. And she's writing in a notebook. It wasn't blue, actually. It was brown. But apparently that wasn't going to be such a good book title. She's writing these little phrases. And so I asked the policeman, who's now very, very close to his car, to come back. And he is not pleased to have to come back down the street. So he comes back down the street and takes me, and I say, would it please be possible to see what this girl's written? And you know, please, and da-da-da. That is not the intonation he used for me to see the book. He barked. She, you know, turned towards me and gave me her book. Now, obviously... think about it. This is a lady who no one's ever expressed interest in her writing before. This isn't her domain of interaction. This isn't a lady who's ever met a tourist, let alone somebody. I was wearing a grey suit and had a stethoscope around my neck and had a team of people sort of milling around, I would say, you know, coming in and out of streets. And so that was obviously strange. But nonetheless, all of that strange aside, the one thing that no one had taken of hers was this book, right? So you think about what that, you know, in retrospect, I suppose, perhaps it was wrong of me to ask to see it because this was something that no one else could touch but her. And I suppose in retrospect, it was a terrible thing perhaps to have done. I'm sorry. And so I saw her book and I've looked at it. The chap actually, the policeman couldn't read it. It was in Marathi. And I looked at it and sort of nodded and smiled and gave it back. And she took it back. And that was the interaction. What I will tell you about her, because she subsequently haunted me, was that she was physically small. I mean, far about so high. For the podcast, that's about 5 foot tall. About so high. And she was what in America would be called petite. but I wouldn't describe her in that. That isn't the vision I have of her, of petite. She's just small, like a contracted human being. But the interaction, because normally when you meet somebody, and I think, and I've never found this to be untrue, there's always an interaction when you meet somebody, whether it's positive or negative. Whether there's always some sense that there's two people, you know, in the playing field. What absolutely struck me about her is there was nothing. I'm being absolutely serious. It was like interacting with this big white concrete bolt here. That's just what it was like. There was nothing. There was nothing. Even when she gave me her book, there was no sadness, regret, interest, nothing. When I gave it back, nothing. When I said goodbye, nothing. She was a complete, if you like, block of concrete for the sake of explaining that style of interaction. It was an extraordinary person. And to me, having come out of this sort of quite unpleasant experience, which I'd really not done well with at all, there was something absolutely enormous about this immovable block of concrete who was enduring more than some rich Westerner had endured a millionfold, 10 millionfold, whatever, you know, scales of magnitude. And that really struck me, even at that moment, was this was somebody who's completely in isolation, had isolated herself. And off I go. The only two other things I'll tell you about that is that subsequently, that exact evening, 6 o'clock, back at the hotel, luxury hotel, it's actually Oberoi, which for those of you who, you know, this was one of the hotels attacked in the tourist attack. But I'm sitting out on this absolutely luxury, they've got a veranda that overlooks the water, and everyone, all the rich foreigners, myself included, are sitting there drinking martinis, looking out over the ocean, you know, pondering whatever it is we ponder. You know, whether we got upgraded to business class, you know, all the really important things in life. And literally like this, and this has never happened before or since, or nor do I hope it will happen again. But literally, I just imploded. I imploded. It was just an insult. I was just reading a book, and I shut the book, and it was like, I just started sobbing. It was the most bizarre thing. The second most bizarre thing is that no one actually did anything about it. You know, people were sitting like right. You know, no one actually said, "Are you okay? Do you want another drink?" Yeah, it was very interesting and a very, very, very strange experience. And then just very, very briefly over the next few years, I'm back in the USA and I have some projects to do, and to cut a long story short, one of the projects I have to take on something. And for whatever reason, and however bizarre, it's not relevant for right now, but I decided to write a novel only because it's something you can break down into segments, 1,000 words a day for 60 days, you've got a novel. And it was just to demonstrate how all of us can take on a project and complete it. That was the entire experiment. In fairness, this girl had been haunting me, by which I mean I'd woken up several times and seen her looking down at me. That's a bit psychotic, but there you go. And so the two things, it was an opportunity to try and, I think, get this out of my system in a very meaningful but quick, structured way. The Blue Notebook. Now, that's great. It's a work of fiction. And so in science, I mean, we spend all our time trying to do things, not trying to put it in a patronizing way, but in, you know, obviously in the public good, we're trying to advance the health of people. And we spend a lot of time and we spend a lot of funding dollars, we do a lot of work trying to build programs that change people's attitudes and the way people behave and think about things for good. I mean, I work in obesity and health and care, we work with kids and all this kind of thing. And year after year and grant after grant and paper after paper, we work to try and bring health to people. And all of you following the childhood obesity, adult obesity, ill health, diabetes and all this, you realize that's an uphill battle. So I published this novel as a project, and all of a sudden the book is bought. It's sold in 36 countries around the world. It's been translated into 21 languages. I didn't know there were 21 languages, but obviously now I do. And I've just got back from Sweden. I'm going again to Sweden in a few weeks. And Australia, France, Korea, South Korea. As somebody described North Korea, a large open prison. Anyway, so South Korea, and so on. And what I found absolutely extraordinary for a piece of fiction is, first of all, if you think about all of this, to me, amazing. You've got this little girl standing in a street in Mumbai, and her tiny little voice, her tiny little writings have been heard right across the world. Right? And this is the voice of a child enslaved as a prostitute. And her little voice, whether it's whatever her voice is, whether it's just of the fortitude of the child, how children mentally estrange themselves from horrific situations, whether it's a call to end what is slavery, right? Slavery of adults ended, 200 years ago? How about us as children? Whatever it is, this little girl's voice has been heard in 36 countries, and I think that is an extraordinary thing. And whether it was segued, or whatever the term is, through some, you know, foreign scientist who happened to be there at the wrong place at the wrong time, is to me irrelevant. It's just merely the extraordinary observation that this little girl's voice has been heard right across the world. I think that is extraordinary. The other thing I've found quite extraordinary and actually incredibly humbling, and I don't really view myself, I actually did write the book, as somebody quite recently accused me of not doing. I wrote the book, but what I'm about to say, I mean exactly as it sounds. I don't feel as though I'm the author of the book, by which I mean I sort of feel as though I'm sort of wandering around the world carrying this little girl's notebook, showing it to you or showing it to the reader, sort of almost as sort of its ambassador, and that's actually quite an honor to do that, to be the bearer of such a burden. And so, you know, I've been to Australia and they had sort of Child Freedom Week on the back of the book. I've been to France where groups of social workers, police, psychologists went out into the streets and started pulling kids off and then interestingly made a reality TV show about this. I've been to South Korea where they have these injection army units that go in and any brothel with children are in an army-like SWAT event, shut down instantly. And so the point being is this, you know, dissuades brothel owners from holding children. I've been to a program in Italy, which is a big center of child trafficking. This is one of the big problems. Italy is, for reasons that are not important, is a big center for the trafficking of children. I was in Kansas just a few weeks ago, and they just passed laws protecting, again, to do with the trafficking of children, protection of children. There was the Women's Safety Act that went through the Senate just under a year ago. And on and on and on and on and on it goes. And I'm not, nor would I for a second suggest that this little girl is sort of is opening up this sort of huge bunch of flowers that's going to be the solution to this absolutely horrific situation, which absolutely has to end. But I would suggest that she is a piece of that puzzle. Her little writing is a brick in that wall. And I suppose ultimately the wall is the house, and the house is the place that's safe for the children, these kids, to come out and live. And that's Batuk's story. I'll take any questions you may have.
You certainly had the imagery of that street, but I suspect you had to do a lot of research beyond that. Could you talk some about that research?
Yeah, with pleasure. When I started out in this game, so to speak, of trying to work out how to bring modern, you know, Western solutions, if you like, or, you know, some sophisticated solutions to very impoverished areas, the traditional I went in is, we got this, we got that, we can do this, we can do that, and you expect everyone to be totally excited about this. But I've got lots of hysterical stories. I mean, in India, for example, I remember buying this $7,000 piece of equipment back off the people who'd stolen it from us for $100, right? I mean, it doesn't work that way. So over time, what one realizes is whenever I go into these places, I go with social workers, field workers, and I say, look, I don't want a translator. I don't want to know what you're saying, but I would just like to be in the room and sit on the floor, always on the floor, so you're below the eye level of the people you're working with. It's just a basic sign of respect. And I'd just like to be in the room. Don't refer to me, don't look at me, and so on and so forth. And so this is exactly what I did in this situation. The main field worker I worked with was Raheen, Jahangi is her last name. And she's a fantastic, she's actually a trained clinical psychologist who runs the children's program I work with, just about 150 meters from where Batuk stood. So I used to just go out with her into the streets. And we go into the rooms where these ladies work. And just to, again, just to paint a picture. So we go into the room. And I tell you, it is a bizarre thing, I will tell you this, for a gentleman to stand on these worn stone entryways which have been worn by feet. And you're standing there in a room. You see where that white hot column is over there. From here to there is the size of the room, but smaller. And in that space is one bed, two bed, three bed, four bed, five bed. Each of these beds are elevated on concrete blocks or stolen car batteries. The lady or child who's working there, her space, her living space, is the bed for work, and below the bed is her space. And that's how these rooms are set up. Room after room, building after building, and these are not, you know, these are not sort of Wells Fargo building style places. These are dark, dank, you know, stepping over dead animals kind of thing. And so that's exactly what I would do. Day after day, I'd go with Raheen, and I just follow her around, and I just sit in these rooms. Very interestingly, it cuts both ways, because she would use me all the time. By which I mean she would, her job is to try and entice these kids and the madams to release them into these educational programs and in medical help. And she would say, look, I've brought this European doctor with me, you know, kind of like, you know, this guy's come all the way from the United States. You know, and I could see she was like referring. It was like, you know, I'm happy to be used sometimes. And so that's exactly how one does this. I mean, hours and hours and meeting the children is something, you know, I've done my best, but you can't do justice to the power of these children, the concreteness of these kids to just hang in there without a hope of a hope, without a tomorrow, and just the fact that they come in every day, they show up every day, they survive every day, and somehow in that day, you watch a kid for an hour, they'll laugh, they'll play, they'll josh, they'll... So that's how you do it. Any other questions?
I don't think anyone else is here from my school, but I'm an instructor at Normandale Community College, and we've actually adopted this book as our common reader. So I'm going to... I think you'll be contacted sometime in the future to speak.
I think I have been already, and I've already accepted.
Oh, excellent.
I think Normandale shrank at my speaker's fee.
Oh,
yes, because it was less than... it was rough. It was rough. It had a lot of zeros in it, but no digits.
it's a... Funding is always an issue.
Not for me.
I put this on my syllabus to teach freshman composition, and we're doing themes of embodiment in the class, and this is the last work we're going to use. And as I read it, I've already had it on the syllabus, and you know, and I'm excited to teach it.
Thank you.
But I have to admit, as I read certain parts, I'm like, oh, you know, this kind of, I guess it's my Catholic upbringing rose up. I'm like, oh, I don't want to talk about these things with my students because of some of the extremely difficult, like there were times I had to put the book
down. Everyone says that. Yeah. They put the book down, but you kind of feel it, you're obliged to batuk to pick it up.
I finished it in a couple days, as much as I was putting it down. So, the assignment that I'm having my students do is they have to write a persuasive pamphlet alerting people to the issue of child prostitution in India, particularly. We're also going to watch Born into Brothels.
Yes. Fantastic.
Which is a little different take on children, the children of prostitutes, but a beautiful, another movie that made me cry and a book that made me cry. So I'll just, my point is to help them see that something like this is important to them, although it's so far away. And one critique I often hear for any issue where people care about what's happening somewhere else is, well, there's so many problems here, you know, I'm hoping that through the book and the movie I could get my students interested and passionate, you know, not maybe to change the world, but just to care.
What's wrong with changing the world? I've got so many comments, I just haven't got enough time to respond to everything. Can I just make a couple of comments, if I may, and I don't want to take up too much of your time. Thank you, obviously. Thank you. I've actually worked with high school kids on this book. And they wrote, what they did, various schools do different projects, but one project was really interesting where all the kids had to write about one of the characters in their own voice. So kids wrote about the doctor, you know, the very unpleasant doctor who examines her in the hotel. The kids wrote about, you know, the man in blue and all different things. That was interesting. That was not as interesting, however, as actually meeting these. So I read all these things before I got there, and they were very, very good and interesting. But meeting the young people was... One boy, for example, came up to me right? We were just having a session. We're just talking and going through things, talking about writing and all this. But a boy came up to me and said, he got up spontaneously, right? Walked towards me. I must have said something. He said, "If anyone ever did anything like this to my sister, I will kill them." That's exactly what he said, almost word for word. And I've had that response half a dozen to a dozen times, I would say. So, in other words, people, truly young people particularly, really connect to this character, to this young lady. They sense a kinship. And I would say my feeling is we're very bad at adults at doing this, but children are not. Children are really good at doing this. They understand that all children are children. They're all our children. They're all one child. They're a collective child. We're very bad as adults at realizing all these children are our children. Just in a way, obviously not the same, but not in a way disconnected from the notion that all children are ours. And that said, to forget that this is, and again, when I started talking about the Blue Notebook, I would say this, and the response to what I'm about to say was uniform. So I'll say what I've said, and I'll tell you what the response used to be. Don't think that childhood prostitution is isolated to India or Thailand or France or Italy, Minnesota, Minneapolis. It's in our state. There are about 300,000 child prostitutes in the United States of America, CDC estimation. And I can send you the citation. And uniformly the response was just what you felt in the room. It was sort of this sense of shock. And then what would happen is what often happens when you talk about child issues internationally is people look away, and you can sense that. It's sort of immediately, if it's a far away, I can sort of handle it. Cognitively, I can deal with it. It's not here. It's not immediate. It's not me in this city. It's not within a mile from here. But the notion that this is upon us, there are children doing, you know, enslaved right here, right now, today, this minute, in this city. And there are amazing policemen, I'll tell you, in Minnesota, who are actually awarded and famous for pulling these kids out. It's a particularly amazing city in that regard. But this is an immediate issue, and it is directly relevant to every single one of us living in Minneapolis, although I live in Orinoco. So those are some comments. And the last thing I'd say about the pamphlets, which I love, is I would only make the point, and again, I think people perhaps here today will perhaps agree with this. You know, you can read in the newspaper online information about childhood prostitution, and it's one of these things that, you know, as soon as you see the title, you don't read anymore, because you know it's terrible, you know it exists, you know it's shocking, you know you're going to get upset reading it. But what I've noticed is there's a great power to a narrative, to a fictional piece, where of course the reader isn't in their factual part of their brain. The reader is in their evocative, you know, in their emotive part of their brain, and they're painting the picture in their own heads. And that's a very powerful concept. And so as you build your pamphlet program, which I love, I'd very politely say, you know, what you've got to do is overcome the barrier to the fact, because the fact is deeply known, but we just can't handle it. So I just politely add that as a final comment. I look forward to seeing you at Normandale.
Okay, thank you.
Any other questions or comments? Was this a bit of... Oh, yes.
Did you just have that one interaction with the girl with the notebook, or did you go back to see her?
The answer to your question is yes, and the answer to your question is yes. About a year after I finished the manuscript and it was accepted by Cindy, I went back to meet the girl, because I don't know if this you view this as strange or not, but of course it immediately became a fantasy that she would actually carry her own book, not necessarily person to person, because there's a terrible voyeurism issue, but you know, at least she would be the direct beneficiary of this work. And I just thought she'd have a college fund, she'd have a home, a foster family, all this. That was my fantasy. It's not a terrible fantasy. And so we went back to India to find her and to do that. And we'd already contacted various people in the government I know and all this. But to cut a long story short, actually it was Raheen I went with. And I actually have a picture of her, which of course I wouldn't show you because, again, of this voyeurism issue. But she's obviously as described. And so we went around with this picture to the madame saying, "Do you know where she is?" And one of them, not hers actually, or at least, you know, the one that covered those cells, but one of the other ones knew exactly who she was and didn't know where she'd gone. And of course, you know, one then immediately has, you know, a romantic notion that she's sort of been rescued and somehow she's, you know, out of the system. But the true likelihood, to be blunt, again, without wanting to upset anybody, is that she was trafficked south and sent out in the trafficking system. So that's that. So thank you all very much. I am going to finish reading the back poem of the book because it wasn't the original ending of the book. And Cindy said to me, and I was just rushing off somewhere, I'm not having the ending you've written. You need to give me another ending. And so, you know, that's how we are as people, right? So I've invested all this work in this and I wanted this book to do something. And so sometimes when you're pushed in that last moment, you do something. And I wrote this in one go. And it ended up being the end of the book. And so I think it's the bottom line. What do they call those notes that we all read instead of reading books? Yeah. This is the cliff notes of the whole thing. And this was a piece of paper that was folded in half and inserted into the blue notebook. And it was handwritten in pencil. And the poem is called A Hat's Tale. Everything is foretold. Yet in all we have choice. Our good deeds sit upon a scale. Tilt it this way and the sun rises, tilt it that, and all that remains of the flame is a spiral of smoke. Everything is given, yet upon us all floats a veil. The vendor, happily, extends you credit, but as you borrow, he shall write it down. Every night the collector makes his rounds, and takes from you asleep precisely what is his. For your debt is inscribed, and your judgment truth. So thank you all very much indeed.